friends. Selamat datang, teman-teman. This is Nis, and you're listening to Archipelagos, a podcast about the ghosts, supernatural beliefs, and mystical curiosities of Indonesia. Now, if you're a fan of switchblades, butterfly knives, and stilettos, because who isn't, then boy, do I have the episode for you. Today, I'm going to be talking about a weapon, specifically the Indonesian dagger known as keris. This word might sound familiar to you. It's come up a few times in the podcast. For example, the stories about objects being inhabited, or maybe people being impervious to stabbing during a trance. Keris exist in many parts of Indonesia, and even around Southeast Asia, but it's most commonly found, and has the most history and embedded culture, in Java. Keris have another name that's sometimes used, which is Tosan Aji. This means respected iron, and is actually used for all traditional weapons made from iron. The form of keris as we know it today has been pretty similar for a few hundred years now. Influenced by daggers from China, India, and Vietnam, there's no definite time of origin for when keris started to become widespread. There aren't any written descriptions of it before the 15th century, but the word does appear on an inscription from the 9th century, so it's believed to definitely have existed since at least then. One of the most recognisable features of keris is its asymmetricality. If you look at the blade, which is called the wilah, it's slightly off-centre from the hilt, which is called the hulu. That blade, which is quite thin and narrow, is sharp on both sides, wider at the hilt, and pointy at the tip. And they usually measure anywhere from 15 to 50 centimetres long. The keris is also always kept in a sheath called the waranka. Another distinctive feature of keris, though not all of them have it, is a wavy blade. The shape is kind of like the one a snake makes when slithering on the ground. There are also many that have straight blades, and some even that have both. So these ones start out straight at the hilt, and then have a few curves about halfway down the blade towards the tip. Wavy keris always have odd-numbered curves, and these curves are called luk. Typically, keris can have as little as 3 and as many as 13 curves. The number of curves can have a meaning as well. For example, a 5-luk keris were reserved for kings and his descendants. The sheath and hilt are usually made of wood, but some of the more fancy keris might have hilts made of ivory, water buffalo horns, or fossils. The majority of hilts are mostly in the shape of a handle, but some hilts are also carved into shapes. You can find hilts in the shape of the Javanese mythological character Samar, in the shape of dragons or birds, or also fairly common, intricate and detailed carvings and patterns. The sheath and hilt are also the parts of the keris that get decorated or embellished. This can include gold or precious stones, but this level of decoration is usually more the exception rather than the rule. These embellishments can have meanings as well, while also alluding to the high social or economic status of its owner. A farmer's keris will be plain and made of wood, for example, made to be practical and actually used. But someone from a royal court, they might have gold on the sheath, rubies on the hilt, and the keris itself might not even see any action if the owner's always safe under the protection of bodyguards. The blade of the keris is essentially made from iron, and often also contains nickel. Some of the older keris apparently also have titanium mixed in. These keris are the ones said to be made using metal from meteorites. So apparently Java often got meteorites falling over the centuries, and it's said that these iron meteorites are the best type of metal to use to make keris. There is one especially famous meteorite from the 1700s that still exists today in the Surakarta Kraton, or Royal Court. Some stories I read said that the skilled blacksmiths from centuries ago would watch the skies looking for meteorites. Whenever one was spotted, they'd all race off to look for it, to be the one who could lay claim to that meteorite and use that valuable metal that it contained. These skilled blacksmiths, known as mpo, could manipulate the mixture of these metals and form certain patterns on the blade. These patterns are called pamor. This happens when the different metals are folded over and over in a certain way, resulting in a kind of lighter grey marbling effect against the dark of the iron. The more skilled the blacksmith, the more beautiful patterns of pamor that they could make. These blacksmiths, or mpo, are actually one of the more interesting aspects for me personally. I think it's fascinating that there have been well-known blacksmiths throughout Indonesia's history who forged famous keris and have legends associated with them. I wonder what it says about Indonesia and its culture and people that a blacksmith can be legendary. I will expand on these famous stories and legends about keris and their makers in a little bit. So as you can imagine, keris were originally used for battles, fights, and as a weapon of self-protection. I read a quote from a Portuguese apothecary named Tomé Pires, who spent time in Indonesia in the early 1500s. He observed that all houses had a keris, and any male over the age of 12 would carry a keris when leaving the house. So it goes to show just how important they were in society, but also personally, because these types of keris were often handed down through the generations. Apart from its use as a weapon, keris were also worn as part of an outfit, and this is still in practice today. Men attending a typical Javanese wedding wearing traditional dress, for example, will also carry a keris with them, tucked into their waistband on their lower back. But apparently most people nowadays only carry replicas, and some even only carry dummy keris, which are just a hilt attached to the sheath. The place where you carry your keris has a meaning as well. During peacetime, ceremonies, or when facing the king, for example, keris were always worn at the back. The keris was only worn at the side during battle, or to signify to people that you're ready to fight. Interestingly, the more mystical aspects of keris seem to be a relatively modern thing. The belief is that the keris's use as a weapon started to decrease sometime in the 19th century, when the political landscape changed and firearms started to become more common. So, with that decrease in its function as a weapon, its function as a symbol then increased. It started to be used more ceremonially, as well as having a more pronounced mystical place in society. Related to this, there's also a slight difference in the shape and features of different keris, depending on what they're used for. Keris that were actually used for protection and fighting were more plain, without much decoration, and with a sturdy but light blade. Keris used for ceremonies, on the other hand, were smaller, with the hilt and blade as one piece, and with more of those embellishments that I mentioned earlier. But before I start on the more supernatural aspects of keris, I just wanted to quickly mention that you can actually really easily buy keris, even online. Obviously, I want to add a caveat here that you can't just trust the information that's provided, especially when buying from a random guy on the internet. I'd assume that a lot of these are keris that are made for souvenir purposes, and that their value or authenticity should be double-checked. Having said that, you could probably find some older, genuine keris, but I think you'd need to have a trained eye to spot the real ones from the fakes. Just like with any other historical artifact, an authenticated keris can go for quite a bit. There was a keris on display in 2018 from the Majapahit Kingdom, which existed over 500 years ago. This keris was valued at 3 billion rupiah, which converts to about 200,000 US dollars. So yeah, not an amount to be sniffed at. But if you don't have a spare couple of hundred thousand lying around, don't worry, I got you. I just looked up a keris on one of Indonesia's e-commerce sites and found an 11-look keris with a wooden hilt and sheath. This one has a name, as a lot of them do, which is Chris Kiai Setan Kober. And that name's actually based on a famous Chris from history. It's not really clear if they're trying to pass it off as the real thing or just being influenced by that famous one. In this listing, the Chris's functions include sending curses, getting rid of enemies, building up strength and authority, and it can also make you feared by many. All of this for the low, low price of 3 million rupiah, which is about 200 bucks. Not bad, right? Okay, now that we've got all the facts and figures out of the way, we can talk about the main attraction, which is the Chris as a mystical and supernatural object. And I think it's only fitting that we start with the makers of the Chris themselves. So even though, as I mentioned before, most Chris were used for their intended purpose as a weapon, the mystical connotations and applications have been hanging around for hundreds of years. Remember how I told you about the Mpu, the name for famous blacksmiths who made Chris? One of, if not the most famous, of these blacksmiths was named Mpu Gandring. Now he was tasked with making a Chris by the founder and king of the Singhasari kingdom in East Java in the early to mid 1200s. That king's name was Ken Arok. Ken Arok wanted a Chris that could kill his adversaries with one stab. So he requested this from Mpu Gandring, who was known to forge powerful and sacred Chris. Mpu Gandring said he could fulfill this request in a year's time, but Ken Arok was impatient and he said he'd be back in 5 months. Now, I want to just quickly add before we continue that I have read that though plain Chris, you know, like the ones sold as souvenirs, can be made in only a few days, many of the finer and more complicated Chris do take months to make. And highly skilled Chris blacksmiths would only make 2 or 3 a year. So Mpu Gandring's condition of needing 1 year was not unusual. But let's get back to the story. So sure enough, in 5 months' time, Ken Arok returns to Mpu Gandring, and though the Chris has been forged, it's not yet refined to his high standards. In another version of the story, the Chris itself is finished, but not yet its sheath. Either way, the asshole Ken Arok gets angry and stabs Mpu Gandring with the Chris. Before Mpu Gandring dies, however, being a magical person himself, he places a curse on the Chris that he just made and proclaims that it will kill 7 people, including its owner. As the story goes, this curse comes true. The Chris Mpu Gandring, as it's now known, does kill 7 people, including one of Ken Arok's sons, and, yep, you guessed it, Ken Arok himself. So, sucked in Ken Arok. After fulfilling its curse, the Chris then apparently disappears, never to be seen again. So, one interesting aspect we can gain from this story, I think, is the fact that highly skilled blacksmiths, like Mpu Gandring, have long been seen to have the ability to infuse magical powers into the Chris that they make. Firstly, the blacksmith will choose certain metals for their inherent potential and natural power. Next, by performing rituals that can include prayers, fasting, and offerings, the blacksmith can then infuse specific abilities into the Chris. So I've listed some of these abilities or powers for you, and by all means, they're not the only ones, but here's a few. Granting good fortune, ensuring bountiful harvests, bravery, power, authority, protection to its owner, a supernatural force field, far out, that sounds awesome, and finally, anti-possession, which if you've listened to episode 3, you'll probably agree that this is a pretty handy one to have in Indonesia. These blacksmiths were also said to be able to handle the hot iron by hand as they shaped and folded the metal. And I feel like this is one of those yeah right moments, but I watched a video on YouTube of a blacksmith who, straight after quenching the Chris, just casually grabbed the blade and started straightening it to his liking. I mean, I can't even touch a hot plate that's fresh out of a dishwasher. So yeah, maybe they do get asbestos hands, as my grandmother used to call it. Now, with the Chris that are considered to be sacred, Apart from some of those powers that I just mentioned, people attach all kinds of attributes and superstitions to them as well. For example, one of them is that if you point a kris at someone, it means they'll die soon. So guys, please don't do this. Practitioners of pencaksilat, which is an Indonesian martial art, sometimes use kris in their demonstrations. So apparently they touch the tips of the kris to the ground, which then neutralizes that effect. Then there are people who say that the sacred kris can contain things like a power or a being, and that they can actually stand on their tip on their own without anyone holding it. And some say that the kris will do this standing trick only when its name is called. Either way, I won't believe it unless I see it with my own eyes. YouTube's not going to cut it this time, because it goes even further. Some people say that there are kris that can move on their own. I do have a story about this, which I'll tell you about at the end of the episode. Amongst the more mystical believers, they say that you have to perform specific rites and make offerings at shrines to avoid, like, bad juju from a kris. You can even apparently do tests to determine if your kris is lucky or not. One of the ways to do this is to sleep with the kris under your pillow, and if you have bad dreams, then it's an unlucky blade for you, and you should probably get rid of it. But if you have good dreams, then this kris will bring you good fortune, so you should probably look after it. Sacred kris can also give off impressions to those who understand them. They can be described as fierce or stern, raw, strong or influential, and I even read one being described as polite. The run-of-the-mill, non-magical kris, though, won't bring up any special feelings. But apparently, regardless of powers and infusions and all of that stuff, there ultimately has to be a match between the kris and its owner, because it's believed that not all kris will, quote-unquote, work for just anyone. There needs to be a connection. Kris that don't like or don't match with their owner are said to not work or just disappear. So, to maintain that friendly connection with your kris, a serious owner will properly look after their kris. The most common recommendation is to rub oil on the blade, and this can be coconut oil or even jasmine or sandalwood. Many also recommend cleaning with lime juice before the oiling. There's also a specific time that's said to be best. This is between 11 p.m. and 2 a.m. on the 1st of Suro, which is a month in the Javanese calendar. This date is apparently an auspicious one and has other mystical connections, which I'll try to discuss further in the future. But back to the cleaning. The oiling of blades, I believe, is something pretty common, even with knives and swords and stuff, because it's supposed to prevent rust. So that part of it could be a technical detail that has inadvertently been mysticized over the years. For our mystical purposes, however, this cleaning and looking after is also part of the care and upkeep for sacred kris to keep them happy. If you don't continue to look after them, they can lose their powers. So I guess it's kind of like when you don't recharge your batteries. So before I get to the last part that I'll be talking about, I wanted to also mention the Balinese dance called Tari Kris. The Kris dance is part of a bigger dance production called Tari Barong, which is the dance of the Barong. And I think I've spoken about it briefly in episode 6 about the Legong dance. In Balinese mythological beliefs, Barong is the leader of good spirits, and his enemy is Rangda, an evil witch, leader of the bad spirits. The particular section that concerns the kris dance takes place when Rangda places a curse on the male dancers, causing them to want to stab themselves with their own kris. Barong then comes along and casts a spell to make them impervious to the kris, keeping them from harm. These dancers are said to go into a trance when performing, and that trance puts them under possession of unseen beings, who in turn keep the dancers from getting hurt. So, look, I won't say that they don't have any supernatural help protecting them, but I also am not saying that they do. I did a very scientific experiment using a pair of scissors that I pushed into my arm while grimacing and making faces, and my husband assured me it looked really convincing. So I'm going to let you guys decide. And now we've come to the last part that I wanted to share with you guys, and it's about the kris that actually exists in my family. Yep, my family has one. So this kris is in my dad's possession at the moment. Before that, my dad's brother had it, and before that, it belonged to my grandfather. No one in the family actually knows how many generations it goes back, but it's definitely at least as far back as my great-grandfather. I'll be putting up some pictures on the Archipelago social media, so you guys can see what it looks like. The family kris has a wooden hilt and sheath, and a straight blade, much to my disappointment because I think the wavy ones look really cool. My dad keeps it in the wooden box he got it in, which my uncle either bought or had made when he had it. Weirdly, when the kris was passed to my dad, there was another kris in the box that also belonged to my grandfather, but no one seems to know much about this extra one. Now, you'll have to forgive the vagueness of the details in this story because, unfortunately, both my grandparents have passed, but the story goes that my grandfather used to carry this kris around with him during the wartime. Indonesia declared independence in 1945, but fighting against the Dutch and Japanese still continued for some time. So I'd estimate this kris was in service sometime in the 40s. My grandfather was a major in the previous version of Indonesia's official military. At that time, my grandparents still lived in Madura, an island off East Java. It's not known exactly how or when, but somehow my grandfather's kris got lost during this wartime. According to my dad, the kris then just showed up by itself on the front doorstep the next day. And if you're getting, like, the One Ring vibes from Lord of the Rings, you're not alone. Just know that when the kris is unsheathed, you don't disappear like Frodo, because I have tried it. Anyway, so from then on, since the kris came back, my grandparents just kept the kris at the back of a cupboard, wrapped in newspaper. My aunt also told me once that when she was helping my grandmother tidy up, she saw the kris in the back of the cupboard and asked about it, and she got the same story of it just coming back by itself. After my grandfather passed away, the kris then went to my uncle. He didn't really believe in this kind of stuff, but apparently he did take it to an orang pintar. Orang pintar are those mystical, supernatural people, the ones that have kind of powers, but not the black magic kind. And so my uncle took it to this person, and apparently the kris stood on its tip and started moving on its own. I remember another story that my brother also says he's heard, which is of my uncle taking this kris somewhere for whatever reason and leaving it there and it being back in his cupboard by itself. But my dad and aunt said they've never heard this, so I don't know if my brother and I are just making up stories at this point. And then there's the story of my other uncle, who was also in the military, and he apparently once saw a kris fly in front of him. So the story with this one is, my uncle and his military unit were working with a local orang pintar. This isn't the same one as before, because there are like millions of these guys all over in Indonesia. Anyway, they were working to track down and recover historical artifacts, and this guy was helping them with his powers to track them down. So my uncle and his colleagues show up at midnight in the middle of a soccer field, which is the previously agreed upon place, to find this orang pintar standing there naked. Suddenly, there was a bright light in the sky, and then the artifacts that they're looking for, including kris and spears, start flying in from outside of the field, apparently, and just landing in front of them. Once the orang pintar summoned all the artifacts that he could, he gave one of the kris to my uncle as a gift. So this other uncle of mine was also not really into mystical stuff, and apparently he gave that kris away to someone, but again, this story is a bit light on details. So going back to my grandfather's kris, which is now in my dad's possession, following the family tradition, he just keeps it in a cupboard. My dad did show it to another relative, who also has supernatural abilities, to see what he could glean from it. Now, look guys, you just have to go with it because it's not even that I have a weird family, but in Indonesia, practically every family has at least one relation who can see or do supernatural things. Anyway, this guy takes one look at the kris and he says, "Where's its partner?" Apparently, we only have the male kris, but somewhere out there, beneath the pale moonlight, is my family's female kris match. So on that mysterious and weirdly romantic note, we've come to the end of this episode on the famous and mystical Indonesian dagger, kris. I hope you've enjoyed hearing about another aspect of Indonesia's supernatural landscape. You can connect with me on Instagram and Twitter at ArchieGhosts. And if you have any questions or comments, I'd love to hear from you. Also, if you haven't already, please subscribe on whichever podcast app you use and spread the word. I'd really appreciate it. And thanks again for listening to Archipelagos.